This is Main Street on Prairie Public, the time and place that we come together from the Red River Valley to the Badlands and into Montana and the South Dakota areas surrounding. We come together and have good conversations. A day like this, we're probably going to be talking a lot about the weather and also just about what is on our minds. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and my first guests today are here to talk about a very important topic, the legacies of war and what that can mean to people as we move forward from that. My first guest, Aaron Toole, he is a ceramic artist and the senior laboratory mechanician at the ceramic department at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we're also in studio with Josh Zeiss. He is the lead artist for Project Unpack, and we have had Project Unpack on before. This is sort of a multimedia experience trying to help veterans tell their stories. Josh, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
And we should also mention, Aaron, that you are a veteran. You served in the Marines.
Right, yeah. It was in the 91 Gulf War, Embassy Guard.
We should set this up with what Project Unpack is. I gave it, you know, a 12-word synopsis here, yeah. But Josh, give us more detail.
I'll try to give it a 15-word synopsis.
Okay.
Try to beat that. Project Unpack is an arts initiative through the National Endowment for the Humanities. It was a grant that was written by Dr. Christina Weber of NDSU in the Sociology Department. And it includes Michael Strand, who is the head of the visual arts department at NDSU. He's sort of like the curator and facilitator. And I'm trying to think of all the other people who have helped out. There's just so many people who seem to have been a part of this thing. So here we are. We've done a lot of work recording stories from veterans, either through video or through oral narration. And part of my role is to try to find other ways for them to tell their stories. And I use clay as sort of like a recorder for a story. I have veterans come in. They bring in objects that were meaningful to their deployment. And we stamp those into the cups and we sort of lock them in time. Mm. And it's been really wonderful. We brought Aaron in because we just really love his work, and he's a very prominent figure in for me anyways, because I too am a veteran, and the work that he's doing is really pushing into new ground, I think.
Well, that's generous. They're just cups.
They're just cups.
No, you say that. You say that on your website. They're just cups, but tell about what you are going for. What is it that you are trying to say in the cups that you are making and how it fits into the scope of Project Unpack?
Yeah, I don't think I am qualified to answer that question. I think that's, you know, that's an art historian's problem. you know, I think as an artist or potter or whatever I am, the obligation is to make your work, whatever that is. And, you know, I say they're just cups because they are just cups. You know, anything more than cups is something that the viewer or the person that's holding the cup, or, you know, in the same way with, you know, I've been making and giving cups away since 2001, seriously, and I've made and given away over 20,000.
And wow.
Yeah. Well, so, but, you know, people will let me borrow their insignia and I'll make molds of them and then decorate their cups, or they give me pictures of themselves or, you know, friends and family that were in the military, and I'll make cups for them. And, you know, it's not, but it doesn't feel like it's mine, really. They're there. The cups belong to the people who gave me the insignia, who gave me the images, and, you know, the story is their story. It's not mine, mm-hmm. You know, so it's just.
What is your process for learning that story? Does somebody, is it purely a matter of they hand the insignia? They might give you dog tags. They might give you a photo, and then you just take it from there. Or do you visit with the veteran and say, why did you join? What was your experience? What's the process?
Yeah, it's been – I mean, it's kind of random and organic. I mean, you know, I work at the university, and you maybe wouldn't think that at UC Berkeley there's a lot of vets, but there are quite a few. And so meeting them directly, but then also I've been on – a couple TV shows and things online, and I have some work up at the Smithsonian right now. And so people just, Google search me and find my email address and ask for a cup. And, so sometimes there's a lot of interaction. We get to, like, hang out together. But often it's just I'm making them and sending them back into the void. Like, I have no idea, like, if the person really exists or, but it's just part of the thing for me, I guess, is my grandfather was a Marine in World War II and my father was in the Army in Vietnam, and neither one of them talked about their wars until I came back from my war. Mm-hmm. And I was a little upset about that, but I realized when my son was born and he started asking me about my experience in the military, like how hard that is, to talk about things that you did or didn't do in a context that you can never explain, and to be judged, demonized or idolized for something, is really difficult. And so with the cups, sometimes I think hopefully my hope is that they become a kind of touchstone for people who've experienced war to talk about that experience with somebody they love,
Well, you mentioned your son, and kids have this fantastically beautiful and cruel way of asking questions that just, really stabs you in the heart. Mm-hmm. And he, if I'm remembering correctly, he basically asked you why you were a bad guy and when you became a good guy.
Right. Well, I mean, killing is pretty much universally bad. Everybody thinks killing is bad, and soldiers or Marines, that's the primary job there is locate, close with, and destroy the enemy. Actually, I feel like a lot of vets I've met, I feel like have a desire to serve, and I still do. And, but I feel like now instead of killing, locate, close with, and destroy the enemy by making him your friend, right? Like through education, through empathy, through understanding, it's still, eliminating the threat, but just a different tactic. And whatever. Obviously, that's ridiculous to say. Like, that's my goal. That cups are somehow are gonna make the world a safer place, or that somehow is gonna stand up to genocide. But that's the tools that I have. That's the resource that I have. I can't feel good about carrying a gun anymore, and that's no judgment on people that do. But just for me, I feel more comfortable making lumpy cups than.
Why cups?
For me, that's, I think that peace is the only adequate war memorial. Everything else is at best a failure and often something that promotes war, even if it's unintentionally. But cups, seem like the appropriate scale to talk about war. Like, sitting at the table with you, I feel comfortable that this is broadcast. Now it's going to get weird. because people are going to misunderstand or misinterpret, and they don't have the opportunity to ask me for clarification. And so then it just ferments in their mind, and, I'm some crazy Berkeley liberal, and, they forget that I was in the Marine Corps. But anyway, but the cup feels like the appropriate scale to talk about war, that, it's a hand-to-hand thing. Mm-hmm. Stalin said one death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic. I think that's crap, that, like, a million war dead is an incalculable tragedy. Everybody had a mother and a father, and they're gone, and all that potential is wasted. And, ceramics and cups, that seems like the appropriate scale, and the longevity of it too, right? Like, the cups will last 500,000 to a million years, even if they're just shards. That's still, right now we're at war with X, and it feels like we're always going to be at war with X, but in 50 years we're going to be like, wow, these are really good Vietnamese sandwiches, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Josh, you are a veteran yourself in the National Guard, and you are also a ceramic artist. What does Aaron's work mean to you?
I think there was a friend of mine. He's an artist in Brooklyn. His name's Derek Adams, and I was watching this video of him when he was in his studio talking about his process, and he said, just very basic, very simple, visual art. It's a visual culture. I'm making this stuff because I'm showing you what I'm thinking about. This is what I'm thinking about, because there are no words for what I'm thinking about. And I was thinking about that, and I'm trying to wrap my head around, and I've struggled with it, and I feel like these cups, they are what you're thinking about, but they also help people figure out the words so that they can tell their story, because the words aren't always there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're a way for people to find what those actual words are.
Well, Aaron used a couple words here that really stand out in my mind as veterans are so often demonized or idolized, and there's kind of no middle ground there. And there are always subsets of human beings that we just like to put in one box or the other and don't like to give that whole broad human experience. Yeah. I want to know about the role of Project Unpack and sort of that duty to fill in that gray area in between demonizing or idealizing war.
Our role is to tell stories, to show the everyday life of military service, and to show all of the traumatic things and all of the amazing heroism, and just to keep pushing that and keep pushing that until it starts to get uncomfortable. And we're just going to keep pushing it, because we need to push past our comfort zones in order to actually learn something new, because what we've been doing doesn't seem to be working. So we need to keep pushing and keep getting people to try to participate and open up and share their lives with us and the rest of the world.
Aaron, where does your mind go when you're sitting at the Potter's Wheel?
I'm at the Potter's Wheel quite a bit.
Because, so some of it's like, I got to get milk?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, but it is. Even like right now, you know, there's some 18-year-old kid out there in harm's way. And, you know, that to me, like, just that Josh is a veteran, to me, I feel as a huge personal failure, you know, because, right, like, just the rhetoric around war as, you know, this is World War One, you know, a war to end all wars, like, well, that didn't work out, you know, and so the same, like all my intention, you know, the gap between the stated goal and the outcome was vast and tragic for me. And so, yeah, so it's still, I mean, I'm thinking about those young kids. I have a son now, and, you know, the way things are going, it you know, it's likely he's going to be in some kind of harm's way, if it's school shootings or, you know, or larger, you know, war kind of violence. But, you know, so, yeah, I mean, they are just cuffs. but it is like, you know, it is kind of, I mean, somebody said, like, art is the opportunity of love between strangers. And it really is just, I mean, it feels like a small, impotent gesture, but it really is like, you know, please accept this cup as a gift. You know, please be nice. I'm not used to snow. And looking out the window and seeing all the snow and cold, and it's just like, it makes me want to, like, hug people. like, be safe. Like, we're just, you know, naked apes. like, it's cold. but anyway, I just, sorry, more love, you know.
Oh, yeah.
We'll put some hot cocoa in those mugs.
Yeah, thanks.
you have said in a previous interview that the person who goes to war is not the same person who comes back. What was that experience for you? Who were you before? Do you have a line there?
I'm glad you got tissues on the table here. Try not to cry, but yeah, I mean, I was super naive and super gung-ho and, you know, believed in, like, real easy answers of good and evil, and we were the good guys, and that's that, and no questions. And now things are more complicated. It's, you know, it's harder to have the absolute blind faith. You know, things are difficult. Another artist friend, Richard Nutkin, he makes these teapots, and he says he's quoting some other philosopher talking about the line between good and evil is a line in every man's heart, you know, and it feels more like that. Like, there's no coming back from, like, I see evil in myself that I didn't see before. I see the potential for, you know, doing great harm and bad things that I didn't know, I didn't believe before, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a weird, hard thing. Like, I kind of feel like I lost my ability to point fingers, right? Like, for you know, if things had broken this way or that way, or, you know, that little piece of lead had flown a little bit to the left or right, you know, I wouldn't be here, or, you know, somebody else would, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's just, there's just fewer absolutes. But again, but I do feel like, you know, the requirement to do good things, or to try to do good things, and, you know, do no harm, kind of eat lower on the food chain. Just, you know, it feels more, I feel more of an imperative and, you know, a desire to really, you know, make my time above ground good and useful to other people.
Mm-hmm. Did you make a cup for yourself?
I mean, they're, you know, whatever. Art, just in just making thing is such an act of ego, right? Like, there's all this beautiful, I mean, the cup you're drinking right now is really beautiful.
I did not make it. I found it in a drawer.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah.
But it's very pretty.
So they're all kind of for me, really, but and just sharing. And that's the thing, the generosity of people giving me their photographs or giving me their insignia, and the opportunity to make something that, you know, as an object maker, having the objects you make appreciated and taken care of, you know. And I've had people say that they're going to pass the cups on for generations, that that's going to be their cup, and their son and their grandson are going to, you know, it's going to be part of the inheritance, which is, it's kind of ridiculous, but I really appreciate it, you know, as an object maker. But yeah, and then, but I did have a thing where I made this one cup, and it just got out of the kiln. I was like, this is great. I love this cup. And this woman asked me, can I have that? I was like, man, I just got it. And I was going to fill it up with coffee, and I walked 6 feet and dropped it, and it shattered into a million pieces. And oh, so no. Since then, I have been, like, less possessive about this stuff. I mean, I just laughed and laughed. Like, greedy me, going to keep that cup for myself. And, like, wah, wah. So, yeah. But, I mean, again, you know, I feel really lucky and really blessed, and, you know, that I made it through my war and came back and get to do a job, you know, do something that I believe in every day. You know, working at a university, I think that's a good and noble endeavor. And so just, you know, sharing it is just another, it's more icing and more privilege. And, you know, as a vet, like, being out there and having other vets reach out, younger vets, and or actually backwards and forwards, you know, I was making cups and at a show once, and this Vietnam vet came up to me and started talking, and, you know, after three marriages and, or, you know, he was finally going to the VA and getting some counseling and, you know, and whatever. And just the cups were a place where we could talk about it, and, you know, creating community. And because I think it's, you know, again, it's hard to talk about that stuff. And so the temptation is to just shut off and, you know, get your disability check and live in the basement and not talk. And so, you know, any excuse to get out and hang out. And that's a joke too, right? Like, I thought, oh, like, there was a suicide on campus of that committed suicide, and I came out and got involved with the student veteran group, and I thought I was doing something for them, but I didn't realize how much I had missed that community of veterans, and, you know, like, what a great thing it was for me to, you know, in reaching out to them, I helped myself a lot.
Sounds like there's a lot of self-healing in this process.
That's exactly what I'm experiencing with this project.
Yeah.
It's really helping me a lot.
Yeah. I was just talking to this counselor, and he was saying there were a group of vets, and he called each of them and said, hey, you got to come out for the other guy. And and then they got there, and they realized that, you know, they all came out to help the guy next to them, but really they were there to help themselves, or, you know, it was, anyway.
What have been your experiences with the VA?
Oh, I've got nothing bad to say about the VA.
Yeah.
Our VA. I don't know about other VAs. I've heard things from other VAs. It was very hard when I was in D.C. in grad school. It was a really, really difficult process for me to get enrolled into their system. So I never went there for anything. But Fargo has a great VA. They have really committed, dedicated people there. Every single one that I've encountered.
Have you had interactions where there is sort of this style of healing, the holistic approach? where there is art therapy or there might be music therapy or,
oh, yeah,
or something to that effect.
Yeah, they have a specific person on staff that is meant for creating these sort of experiences for veterans through music and art and theater and whatever. She's out there. She's searching. She's looking around for things to do. And I haven't done anything specifically with them yet, but I really want to. So where are you? Come find me.
Let's go find them.
That's right.
We got canceled. You got a four-wheel drive. Let's go.
That's right.
Yeah, the weather is delaying or possibly canceling some events that, Aaron, you were mm-hmm. actually brought to town originally for. But going back to the VA, your experience is somewhat in the past. Compared to Josh's experience more recent, there have been these people who have been pushing and pushing and pushing for better veteran care over the years. How would you say that back in the 90s when you were experiencing this, what was your experience with the VA?
I've never gone to the VA. I have no experience at all.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I got
just just your choice, or was it
choice,
an access issue?
No, I didn't realize how much of a hard time I was having until I saw the younger guys and like, wow, he's kind of drinking a lot. And like, oh, wait, I kind of drank a lot when I got back to, I didn't seek counseling. I didn't seek help like I maybe should have. Mm. Actually, California has a thing now where you can get a VA designation on your license. And so that's the first contact. It was just last year, but I went out and made contact with the county VA person and turned in my paperwork. So now I'm blessed, you know, sort of, whatever, you know, I mean, I don't know how else to say it, but I'm mm-hmm. like vetted or whatever.
Yeah.
It says I'm a vet on my license. And so it makes it easier. It's a great thing because it helps, you know, homeless people or whatever, people that are having trouble, the cops can identify them directly. Like in Alameda County, they have in the prisons, they have a separate pod, I guess, for vets. So if you're arrested or for DUI or domestic or whatever, they separate you from the general population and put you in a veteran pod. And because you have there's more resources available for veterans. And so people are trying, you know, I mean, but mm-hmm. I think just in general, that's the and it's not just vets, but like, you know, I grew up in South Central Los Angeles and, you know, people affected by violence there, you know, gangs or, you know, just in general, I think, you know, reaching out and community is what I think is really the most important thing for any human, you know, is finding community and sharing, you know, resources or opportunities, you know, but yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah. We just have less than a minute here. Aaron, you are part of a collective called the Dirty Canteen. What is that?
It's actually a younger vet started it, and it's just a group of veteran artists. And we've had people come in and out. It's just younger. I'm the geezer of the group. But we just make work and have shows and turn each other on to opportunities. And it's just another opportunity to make community.
All right. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you.
Josh, thank you for joining us today.
This was great.
We're visiting with Josh Zeiss. He is the lead artist with Project Unpack, and he is also a veteran. You can Google Project Unpack and see the myriad work that they have done over the course of a couple years of the grant. And Aaron Toole, he is a ceramic artist and senior laboratory mechanician at the ceramic department at UC Berkeley. Still to come on Main Street, we stick with this art theme and we visit with Dick Termis, who created a six-point perspective style of painting to create optical illusions. But first, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Department of Transportation has extended its travel alert to the southwest corner of North Dakota. The inclusion means that all of the state is under a travel alert at this hour. The alert means a person can still travel, but should be alert to the potential for rapidly changing conditions. DOT spokesman Brandon Bisey has an alternate recommendation.
You should try to stay home if you can. I mean, it's going to only get worse throughout the day, and we want people to be safe.
Bisey says crews have been out since Sunday as rainfall turned into snowfall. He says after seeing heavy, wet snowfall overnight, the snowfall happening now is a bit drier. However, Bisey says accumulations are starting to develop and winds are starting to pick up.
Visibility is getting to be a little more troublesome. Our plow operators are keeping up with the road conditions fairly well, plowing and treating the roads as needed. Visibility is still a concern.
Despite the ongoing efforts by maintenance crews, Bisey says the current road conditions map shows the state with two types of driving, snow-covered roads or icy roads with compacted snow. UND is getting ready to tear down two more buildings, Robertson Sayer Hall and Corwin Larimore Hall. The Board of Higher Education has given the university the go-ahead, and UND Assistant Vice President for Facilities Management Mike Pieper says the plan is to start demolition is in May with an August completion. What will happen to that space?
Initially, we'll just get it so that it drains well, and we'll get it seeded, and it'll just be some green space. There is some planning going on in terms of maybe some potential uses down the road as part of the master plan, but nothing has really been solidified.
UND has been getting rid of some of its older buildings.
We tore down six, mostly smaller buildings kind of on the edge of campus. Chandler was approved last year. So that one will come down also. There's a number of the low-density single-story housing will also be demoed. That was approved last year.
And all eight North Dakota High School Activities Association Class B Boys Region basketball tournaments have been postponed due to forecast heavy snow and poor travel conditions. Tournaments will now start Tuesday, March 6th. The Class B Boys basketball tournament seating will now be announced on statewide television at approximately 8 p.m. Central Time on Saturday, March 10th, in between championship games at the Super A State basketball tournament in Fargo. Any additional postponements will be posted on www.ndhsaanow.com. And postponement will also be sent to NDHSAA main school contacts and statewide media. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg in studio with Bill Thomas. He is the director of radio here at Prairie Public, and he is joining me to talk with Dick Termus. He is a painter and the creator of the Termosphere, and Dick is based in South Dakota. He is in North Dakota right now to have a show opening, several shows opening, actually. Dick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, happy to be here.
Your work will be on display at the University of Mary, Bismarck State College, Starion Bank, and at the BAGA building. That's the Bismarck Arts and Galleries Association.
Exactly, yes.
And what will be on display? What is a Termosphere?
Uh-huh. Well, there's in the total, there's 24 of them. That are spread around. And a thermosphere, the way I like to think of it is I imagine I'm inside the sphere and it's transparent and I am in a very interesting environment around me. And either I copy what that world is, like it could be a cathedral, and I copy everything above me, around me, and underneath me, onto the ball, but I'm actually doing this all on the outside, but I am imagining I'm inside. So I'm capturing a complete world from one point in space that's up, down, and all around kind of scenes. And sometimes they're very real, and sometimes they're made-up worlds that come out of my head. Sometimes they're geometrical worlds. I love three-dimensional geometries, too. And some beautiful patterns that come out of that. So, you know, basically, and I'm known with the six-point perspective, but what that is it just allows me to take on, like, a complete cubical world around me and lock it onto the spherical painting.
Yeah, you know, Dick, I know that people who study art history, they talk about the discovery of perspective in the Renaissance and
right.
and the whole geometry of it. And you've sort of based on that, but you've taken it to a different form, right? Is that correct?
Exactly. Yes, I just have expanded it. Is kind of what it is, because it really does fit with my work too. The 1 and 2 point Renaissance perspective is really the basis of the beginning of this, and I've just made a progression from that until I end up with being able to see the whole panoramic and everything above me and below me also, with that the sphere allows me to do. And that here's a nice, should I give you a nice simple example of?
Oh, yes, please.
Yes, please.
Well, if you were driving along, and I did this the other day, I was over by Belle Fouche, South Dakota, and I was crossing a railroad track, and I looked off in both directions. The railroad went off to infinity in both directions. So I pulled the car over, and I jumped out with my little video camera, and I videoed that with the idea that here's a railroad track that's vanishing to the north and to the south, and I'm standing in the middle of the road, which vanishes to the east and to the west behind me. And I thought, wow, this is a perfect example. But I need the fifth and sixth point, too. And there were telephone poles running right next to me. And as if I imagined I was inside a transparent ball, I would have the 4 points around the middle of the ball that were the railroad and the roads. And then the telephone pole projected straight above my head to a point above my head. And I could look around, and all the telephone poles around me all projected above my head and below, right below my feet. So that's the basis of the 6 points of perspective.
Dick, that brings up a question.
Okay.
Do you think that being from the Midwest, where we have lots of long straight railroad tracks and long straight roads and long lines of telephone poles, does that have something to do with coming up with 6 point perspective?
I think it could easily. We'll say yes. Yeah, we'll say yes to that.
It almost sounds like you could get dizzy inside your own work, like if you really were inside a thermosphere.
And I actually have painted a couple of them from inside too.
Wow.
And so I had to actually think in reverse because I'm painting it like the real world is when I'm inside the ball. I mean, it's just like the points are all around you just like they are if you're in a real nature scene, you know, natural scene.
Yeah. So it's kind of like sewing. You need to know this upside down, backwards, 4 steps in advance how this is going to turn out.
Well, you do, you know, to start with, I used a lot of grids to help me lay this out on a ball, and now it's so natural that I just get 6 equal distant points on the ball, and everything, I know everything, all parallel, it's the same rule in the Renaissance perspective, all parallel lines go to the same vanishing points, but in this case, it's like poles, so if a road vanishes to the north, if you turn around, it's going to vanish to the south, too, because you're trying to incorporate that complete environment in a painting.
So do you have to have a lot of straight lines in a thermosphere? Could you paint a lot of circles, for example, and have this turn out to your intended desire?
If you're doing like a actual cubical world, which most of our buildings are, our cathedrals, everything is sort of based on the cube, then you've got your north, south, east, west, up and down lines automatically built into it. And one of the really interesting things about you talking about straight lines, every line I draw on one of these spheres when I'm doing the 6-point perspective bisects the sphere exactly in half. So, I mean, it really quickly you go, whoa, there's something mathematically going on here. And I can be in a cathedral, and I can capture that complete environment around me, and it's always, the points are always exactly equal on the sphere, and the lines, every line I draw, no matter where I'm located within that cathedral, bisect the sphere in half every time. If you continued the line around the ball, it would divide the ball perfectly in half every time. I mean, this is my 50th year this year of doing this. 50 years ago, I painted my first 6-point perspective sphere. So, I mean, it's driven me. I mean, it's so interesting how this works that I just haven't been able to give it up, you know.
Yeah, 51 years ago you were painting on flat canvases.
That's
have you
right.
ever yeah. gone back?
The only thing I'll do on the flat is I enjoy optical illusions, and I'll do some optical illusion kinds of things on the flat. Mm-hmm. But as far as painting a painting, I haven't touched the flat surface since it took me a couple years to really get into the sphere. I was going to art school at the time in Los Angeles and at Otis Art Institute there. And then ahead of that, I went to the University of Wyoming. That's where I actually hit on the idea of the six-point perspective on the sphere. So, I mean, I was pretty involved in it, but I was still kind of going, do I give up the flat surface? How could I give up the flat? You know, but I finally did. I finally said, you know, I don't like the flat compared to this sphere.
The sphere lets me
think in a whole different way.
Mm-hmm. You have a big show up mostly at BAGA in Bismarck, but also at the University of Mary, Bismarck State, Starion Bank. And you're going to be doing workshops. There's a reception tomorrow night. This is all dependent on the snow cooperating.
Right.
So I was curious about these workshops. I mean, what do you find when you try to teach this to people? How do people take to it?
Well, I've got some really neat workshops. One of them gets into the perspective. So I actually start with the Renaissance perspective, but I do it through grids. I give the students grids, and we lay paper over the top of the grids, and I go from one all the way to a flat type of six-point perspective with the logic. I give them the logic of going to the sphere. So that's, you know, then that I think I'm doing those in 2 hours, which is a little too much, too fast, but it still will work very well. I mean, it'll get them aware of how to think about a total visual space and how to organize that total visual space. I play a little bit. The four-point perspective is like your panoramic shots you get with your camera.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the smartphones will give you beautiful panoramics, 360 degrees. If you analyze that panoramic photograph and add lines where the lines are going and take it back to the grid, it's exactly the grid I've used for years in four-point perspective. I call it continuous four-point perspective. But it allows students to draw like your camera can get shots. I mean, you can actually make it up yourself. So that's one of the workshops I do. And the other one is I use these magnetic tools. They're actually sticks with magnets and steel balls. And I teach them all the different interesting ways to build three-dimensional structures. And what we're really playing with is the platonic solids, the five regular polyhedron. I teach them how to build those, and then I show how they're interrelated to each other. And that kind of a workshop, you know, is what I use when I create a lot of my art. And I also think that like a sculptor or an architect, really it's right up their alley. And you very quickly you realize that biochemistry ties into those structures and the chemistry itself and the math world. And so it ties across really nicely to showing that the arts aren't one thing and math and science another thing. There's an intermixing, in my mind anyway, of all of that stuff.
A lot of times, too, you are creating an optical illusion as this sphere is sort of spinning around, or you are spinning around the sphere. It changes from convex to concave.
Very true, very true.
Yeah. Are you supposed to touch a thermosphere?
You don't need to.
Okay.
Because they're motorized.
Okay.
They're hanging from a ceiling motor, and they do their own rotating. So what I tell people, you know, I don't overly mind if they touch them, but it disturbs the motion of the art, you know. So it's better if you don't.
What are they made out of?
Most of them are polyethylene plastic. They would be like a light fixture that might hang from your ceiling or be on a post outside of a school or something with a light bulb inside. And I get them before the light bulb hole gets drilled into them, so I have a nice pure sphere. And then the transparent ones are acrylic, or an acrylic ball.
And what kind of paint do you use on them?
All acrylic, yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And, I notice some are opaque, some are transparent. How do you decide with your designs?
Well, it just depends what I'm trying to talk about. The transparent ones, I'm dealing with an inside the sphere, because usually I have holes through the transparent painting that I can see the inside of the ball. So I'm actually designing it so you can be inside and see something, and you can be on the outside and see either something different or whatever. I have one that we just hung at the college here, and it was it's called Politically Correct, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And it's playing with, this has no perspective in it, but it's playing with donkeys on the outside for the Democrats and the elephants on the inside. And when you study it a little bit, pretty soon you realize they're both the same pattern. It's just the inside pattern turns into an elephant, and the outside of that same thing turns into the donkey. And and people will sit and look and look and look at that, and you can say, did you notice that they're the same pattern? Oh, I didn't know.
Where's this one going?
This is at the Bismarck College.
Bismarck State. College. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll have to go take a look at that.
Yeah, it's really, really, really fun. It kind of fits in the political world a little bit today.
It sounds like you like watching people look at your work.
I do, yeah. It's fun because, boy, I've had like young kids come up and they absolutely understand where my head is or was for that piece. And then other people look and look and look and never quite get it, you know. But it's interesting to watch people and see how they react to it.
Is there a certain type of subject matter or content that lends itself to a thermosphere?
Well, yeah. You know, I guess, you know, whether it, I like science and math and geometry. So a lot of that plays into it. But I like to tell people my philosophies. That kind of happens in it, too, a lot of times. I've had some pieces where they, you know, I'm trying to tell a story and where ideas come from. I did one years ago on M.C. Escher is one of my favorite artists, and we were in Italy. I got to be part of a – would have turned 100 years old, and I got to be one of four artists that were selected to show with him at the University of Italy. But part of that trip was we got to go to Ravillo, a little town on the Amalfi Coast, and walk around and see a show of Escher there, too. But it's where Escher kind of, it was his favorite place. And so he and his wife actually met there and I think got married there, too, and everything. But I did a piece where I played off of the environment of the town of Ravillo and had images of his ideas that he came up for all of his prints and stuff were kind of happening around him in a natural way. But if you knew Escher's work, it would help tell the story of where Escher got his ideas from. And it was quite fun. And yet it was a very realistic world, but it just happened to have some of his images around him that were that he was finding in a natural sort of way. But a lot of them. I did one of Einstein. I call it Looking for the Order, and it's showing Einstein with patterns, cubical patterns coming out of his eyes that go out and get larger and larger and larger, and then they come back to him on the opposite side, and it's playing with his theory of curved space that he says that if you look far enough in one direction, you'd see the back of your own head. And this piece kind of plays with that. So those kinds of subject matters I enjoy.
I gather a lot of them are kind of playful, huh?
Oh, very much, yeah. I want people to have fun when they look at it, too, you know?
Now, we're talking to Dick Termas, and he normally is in South Dakota, but he's in Bismarck right now and doing some workshops and having a show there and opening at BAGA tomorrow night, weather permitting. And we heard if you go to the BAGA website, bismarck-arts.org, they are going to try to update with any any changes in Dick's schedule that that may happen because of all that dang snow that we get around here. And Dick, I'm curious, who goes for your spheres? Who's your audience, do you think?
Well, let's see. lots of different people. I mean, I have a lot of them that are in office spaces. I've done, like, some major ones where I compete with – I actually compete with sculptors a lot because my work is three-dimensional, too. And so those interiors that are three-dimensional in three-dimensional space, I can float a sphere in there and motorize it so it just sits there and floats and shows itself. That you were talking a little bit about the illusion. One of the interesting things about the sphere is because I put subject matter on it that's the inside. It's what I would see if I were inside the sphere, but I put it on the outside of the sphere, and the sphere is convex, and your mind wants to push it to concave because that's what the natural way that we see images are all around us, kind of like a concave surface around us, and that I think that's why that illusion works so well because your mind wants to get it back to normal, which is concave. And it'll make a ball just flip inside out, and all of a sudden you'll see it, and it'll just go concave on you. And I see people when they see that, it's fun to look at them and watch them because they just go, "Whoa! Did you see that?" Years ago, my mother actually pretended like she saw that illusion, and then one day she actually saw it. And my goodness, it was really fun to watch her because then she expected everybody to see that illusion when she saw it. She didn't know it was just going on in her own head, you know. Quite fun.
Yeah, it is. It is fascinating how much of what we see is not just what meets the eye, what the mind does that ultimately allows us to see that finished product.
Exactly.
I'm wondering with the Termosphere, and I know you've been doing this 50 years, so maybe you're not even sure anymore, but is this a method that you feel like you had to create because it was how you saw the world, or did you end up seeing the world differently after you created the Termosphere method?
You know, I actually think that this system of perspective is something I didn't invent, but I discovered that it actually is so mathematically sound that I feel like it just was something that had to be discovered or found, you know, in nature. And so I feel like it's always been there. It's just that nobody got a hold of it, I guess, or something. So it's kind of interesting. It's once you really study it a little bit, you realize, like when I do my workshops, I've done workshops on this perspective system, but some of the best ones I did over in Germany for our military high school kids that are stationed with their parents in different countries. I used to get about 15 of them for 8 years. I would go over there and I taught them 1 through 6 point, and in the end, they were doing little spheres of the little towns in Germany and stuff. It was very, very, very fun. And when they finally go through this and they start with 1 point, 2 point, 3 point, when they get to the last, the 5 point and 6 point, they know what they should do without me even telling them.
Hmm.
I mean, it's really a logical step-by-step progression, I think.
Oh, that must be very rewarding. Dick Termas is a painter and the creator of the Termosphere. You can see several Termospheres on display in Bismarck, between the University of Mary, Bismarck State College, Starion Bank, and the Bismarck Arts and Galleries Association building. Dick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's fun.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It doesn't need to be a dark and stormy night to see Agatha Christie's iconic play, and then there were none. At the Fire Hall Theater, theatergoers can guess who done it, March 15th through the 31st. For those who want dinner and a show on Fridays, theatergoers may enjoy fish, chips, and a pint. More information on either or both at 777-4090.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 5th. On this date, in 1918, there was a goat traveling around Fargo, quickly going from one owner to the next. Get the Kaiser's Goat was a unique method for encouraging the sale of war thrift stamps. Consisting of a large portrait of an evil-looking billy goat with the inscription, Der Kaiser's Goat, the package included a book in which the names of the goat-getters were recorded as it was passed from one person to the next. Before the goat could be passed on, a subscription of war thrift stamps, ranging from 25 cents to $10 a month for the rest of the year, had to be promised by the holder. New members also called in to the committee to record their pledge and to track the progress of the goat. The idea originated with the Fargo Forum and was further developed by Walter Cushing and Joe Pierce of the War Saving Stamps Committee of Cass County. The initial drive began at 12 p.m. on March 2nd when A.W. Coupler, chairman of the Cass County Committee, sent the goat on its journey. The order of the goat-getters was so successful that it garnered 27 members in the first hour, raising over $200 in pledges. To ensure that the pledges were honored, the committee collected them at the end of each month. An additional element of fun was implemented in which the individual who was in possession of the goat at noon of each day was declared Grand Goat of the Day, and he who had the goat at sunset was declared Supreme Goat of the Night. So successful was the campaign that Fargo collected over $1,500 in pledges for each month through the end of the year. Other cities in North Dakota soon followed Fargo's lead and established corrals. Within weeks, the novel idea had spread across the United States. Orders for the Kaiser's Goat came in from across the nation within days after an Associated Press article on Fargo's success hit the newspapers. Many developed their own ideas using goat replicas instead of the portrait. And in Fargo and other communities, more than one goat made the rounds. It was a simple, fun idea, and by the end of the first month, it was estimated to have generated $100,000 nationally in the sales of thrift stamps per month. One Indiana newspaper proclaimed that Kaiser's Goat was the goat that made Fargo famous. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Bill Thomas is back in studio with me because he was recently a judge at the state's Poetry Out Loud competition, and he's going to join me to share some of his favorite poems. We also hear from self-care coach Randy Kay, who has a new ebook out on cultivating self-love. That's all coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.